All right, listeners, welcome to another episode of The Edge, the podcast of Cherry Ventures about product and AI. I am Jasper, partner at Cherry in Berlin, and I'm joined by our venture partner Lutz Finger, who is in the Silicon Valley, and he's just welcoming our guests. So we will interview Ferdinand Terme, or Ferdinand from France, who we met at Station F. Nice place to be. You should be there when you visit Paris and many other places, obviously, in Paris. And he will tell us about his startup, Lasco AI, which is in the creative space and is following one of our theses of the age of super creation and how to create tooling around generative AI and make it productive for their part in B2B context. So let's go.
Hey, this time from San Francisco, the Cherry office in San Francisco, together with Ferdinand and Jasper. Yeah, Jasper, how is Berlin?
It's amazing. It's 35 degrees today. I think we still have 32. So I'm also overlooking Berlin, but I'm on the fifth floor. So that's enough in Berlin to overlook the city. Yeah, very much looking forward to the conversation after we met you, Ferdinand, in Paris.
Exactly. Looking forward to. I'm quite excited.
From Paris to San Francisco. Well, Ferdinand, what we like to do is obviously when we have guests like you, just give a quick intro. I learned that you love Stefan Zweig, which kind of like was like, wow, that's an interesting fact. But who's Ferdinand? Or like you pronounce your name correctly in French. And don't tell my wife that I can't say it.
So the French way is Ferdinand. But like we can do it like the German way, like Ferdinand. It's probably easier to pronounce and to get for like English speakers.
The reason why I said don't tell my wife is French and she always makes fun of me not being correctly able to talk.
I think it's better probably for you to say like more useful things in French and Ferdinand, right? On the like must learn which list things earlier.
For us, it would be mostly interesting. Obviously, there's a lot to tell us about your life, but you come from a consulting background, so it's interesting. I come from a consulting background, but you are from a different firm. So interesting to understand how from there you come to this totally chaotic, high risk, low salary world of building a company and what's driving you there.
So basically, actually, when I joined McKinsey as a consultant, I already knew that I didn't want to become a partner, basically. I knew that I wanted to launch my own company at something. And if I joined McKinsey, basically, I joined the Casablanca office, which was like the entry point for like French-speaking Africa. Mm-hmm. And because at the time, I was like, okay, Africa is a super interesting continent, which I still think is true. And like, why not launching something there? Because I had spent a bit of time in Kenya, spent 6 months in Kenya working like chief of staff in a startup. I was like, wow, so many things are going on here. Like, you can really create life-changing products. Which I felt was a bit less the case back in the days in Europe, like for reason of like maturity of the ecosystem. So I was like, okay, let's do it the safe way. Let's try and see like how it goes with joining McKinsey Casablanca. I spent 2 years there and I was like, wow, actually launching a business in Africa is extremely difficult. It's extremely difficult, especially if you're like a foreigner and so on. And it's very difficult also to make a successful tech business. Yeah. And at the same time, I think the ecosystem, especially the French ecosystem, had made like huge progress. And I was like, wow, isn't it a good time for me to go back home and to launch something to contribute to the economy of my country, but also like to launch something in a more like thriving ecosystem. And at the time I tried a few ideas on the side. For example, I made an audio guide of like points of interest in Paris. And I was like, no, I didn't forge a strong enough conviction for me like to launch something. So I decided to make an intermediate step and join Alma, which is like a kind of competitor of Klarna doing buy now, pay later. Then I spent 2 years at Alma contributing to the hyper growth of the company. I joined, we were around 50 employees. I left 400 employees. And this kind of confirmed that I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I also learned like what hyper growth means, the pros and the cons. Yeah. And I was like, okay, now I feel ready to launch my own thing.
And how did you get your own thing?
So it has been a bit of a hectic way. I mean, the good thing when you join a startup is like, especially like in that hyper growth phase, you see a lot of things. You see a lot of pains. So I left Alma together with my two co-founders. And we were like, okay, we both want to launch something. We both have a bunch of ideas. Now let's just explore and figure out what exactly we want to do. And so to be honest, like we spent 6 months working on fintech ideas because we were like, you know, a bit like Basebook. We were like, that maybe come from the consulting background, you know, like you want to follow the framework. I was like, okay, we have consulting, we have like fintech backgrounds. Let's figure out a fintech ID. But like for some reasons, probably like our fault or the market fault or whatever, but at the end of the day, it's always your fault. We didn't figure out like a good fintech ID. Then we were like, okay, what other pains do we know? And my co-founder had launched a product like for designers before. I had worked in the marketing team, so I knew all the pains around like creative assets. And we met the third co-founder who had been working on generative models for images for 3 years. And basically, at the beginning, it was a bit like, okay, it looks like we know the pain. Looks like we have a good founder's market. Let's give it a try, you know? That's a bit of a mixture because like own experience and opportunity.
It's really interesting how you saw different business models and deliberately chose that one and also that area. Maybe for all other founders listening there who are thinking about Africa and who are thinking about fintech, what is something you would recommend to these people, what they should really understand and consider before building something in Africa or building a fintech from someone who deliberately says, no, I want to do something else?
I haven't built anything in one of those two areas. I think like it's just what I will say is to be taken with, you know, a grain of salt. Africa, my like view, like the conclusion basically I came to is that being successful, it's very hard to build like a successful business. And most of the successful businesses out there, like traditional businesses. So if you want to make furniture or like services, it can work. You can have like very profitable, very beautiful businesses, but it requires to be hands-on, to spend like 10 years in the country, like build local relationships and so on. So I think there's like the first question is really a lifestyle question. And this is basically the choice I wasn't ready to make. And of course, you have some good fintechs and so on, like Nigeria fintech scene is awesome, like Kenyan fintech scene is awesome, but most of the business that actually work are non-tech. So that's my learning for Africa. And for fintechs, basically the conclusion I came to is that the space has been extremely hot over the last 4 or 5 years. So I think either you go on something like very close to the rails, like payment rails, like you have Numero, for instance, in France, like they're doing like connecting the like really banking APIs and so on, or you do something like very verticalized. So for example, like one of the last ideas that finally we didn't pursue was like payments for like healthcare in Europe, like connect all the insurance refunds and so on. I'm sure they, I'm not sure. Otherwise, maybe I would be doing that. I don't know. But I think there is something to do here, but yeah, that's it. Like either very technical in depth or very verticalized. Otherwise, I think it's super difficult to create something that works in fintech today.
Yeah, I like the thinking a lot. And I think that's a good leeway to talk about business models.
You spoke something very often when I'm in class and I talk to students. There are so many students who say like, oh, I wanna be an entrepreneur. And then I look at them again a year later and they are at McKinsey. What would you recommend people who want to become an entrepreneur? You said just a second ago, and I knew that this is the right thing for me. It sounded like a declaration of love. And I met her and I knew that she was the right one for me. What do you recommend for somebody who says, oh, and many of our listeners actually think about entrepreneurship, right? Like, would you do the same journey again? How do you figure out whether you have the itch that you want to become an entrepreneur?
So I think that's a bit, you know, two questions. The first one is like, how do you figure out you're made to be like entrepreneur is a good path for you? And the second one is, would I do the same thing? So if I take the first question first, I think I always love building things or leading projects. So for example, back in business school, I led the like student, we have like, if something in French, we see like student-led consulting firms. So basically, you're like your own CEO. We made like around 500K revenue. So with a team of 10 in total. So like I was managing my own business back in the days. And I was like, wow, that's exciting. You know, that's super tough. And sometimes we work till like 3 a.m. and so on, but that was cool. This is, I think, the first step. Do you like that type of uncertainty? Do you like being at the end of the day accountable if things fuck up? And also the second thing is like try to build things yourself. So for example, that's also when I think I realized I wasn't maybe mature enough when I built this side project in parallel with McKinsey of this like city audio guide. And I was like, wow, actually it's, I have no clue how to do this. I think I was expecting a bit of an overnight success because when you're in consulting, you have very, very fast validation signals. Mm-hmm. So basically if your slides are very bad, your manager will call you and say, well, what did you do? Like it's really, really bad. And so you have an instant answer for the market. When you are an entrepreneur, it's way harder. You need to figure out to deal with a lot more uncertainty. And I think these two things like made me feel, okay, actually, I liked that, but I saw also like what was missing. And this is also why I decided to join Alma and discover like what's for real entrepreneurship.
I can really resonate with that because I guess at a consultancy, it would be comparing it to a startup, you would just do the slides yourself and you go directly to the customer and present them, get a direct feedback loop, which could be positive or negative, but you don't have that. So it feels a bit numb. And then you also, with your recommendations, you just don't know what the customer is doing with them later on, which feels annoying. Yeah. I like the building part. As you can see in the background, I do a lot of building in my private time. Cool. Shall we jump into your product? So, and the motivation for doing it, because it's totally different than Furnitures in Africa and fintech.
What are you building? Yes.
So basically, with my two co-founders, we're building Lasco. And Lasco is AI designers for marketing team in small and medium-sized organization. So these designers, they produce on-brand visual assets. They are available to anyone in the marketing organization, even without like any design skill. Mm-hmm. And they are accessible within the marketing workflows, starting with a Slack integration. So basically doing that, we bring an additional capacity to the company, to the marketing team, and they can express their brand like without limits. And they can basically with that, like compete against their largest competitors who have like huge design teams, brand, like content teams and so on. So this is it like in a minute.
Just to make it more clear what is in there, it's not just the asset creation, it's also the asset variation, it's detailing, but it's also a database that has a structured overview of what assets are out there. So I could search it. And then I could even alter the assets based on maybe customer feedback, et cetera, without needing to open any product from Adobe and the like.
Exactly. So like the product is still very early. Like we launched, mm-hmm. we shipped the MVP in April. So it has been just a few months. But yes, you have this image generation, which relies on a fine-tuned model on the brand identity of the company. And then there's like what we're currently building, like for example, a gallery. So you can access and anyone can access to any visuals that has been generated in the past. And what we build around that is, for example, like what we already have also like editing. So if you want to make a variation, we have like within the gallery, you can search for past visuals and so on.
Nice. And for us, this is a little bit in our thesis of the age of super creation, where we say it's more building the tooling around these amazing models, how to tame them, how to control them. So I think this leads definitely to a technical part for Lutz to understand how you can tame this beast.
Can you walk me through a typical user flow? Like I have a logo. Think about the Cherry logo. I like beautiful color, text. And now and what would I now as a user do? So I'm in the Slack channel. All you have is a Cherry logo. And now?
So I think that basically to get it right, our product works in two steps. The first one is it's basically we do a call with you. Like we haven't productized actually the first part of the value proposition. You share with us your brand identity. So you give us access to your Figma, to your like Google Drive. We want to understand also what your brand is about. Then we get your assets and we train a custom model on your assets. So we train a LoRa, as you said. It can be several LoRAs depending on the complexity of your brand identity. So the example of the logo might not be the right one because usually you always want to keep the same logo. But let's say you have a mascot. So for example, let's say you are Duolingo. You have Duo, like fun green owl. We train the model on Duolingo. That's the first part, on the Duo's mascot. And then the second part is that you can access within Slack or on our platform an image generation solution where you can say, oh, okay, actually, I wrote an article about, I don't know, holidays. So it's where like holidays, summer holidays are starting. I put the text of my article here and I generate a few visuals of the mascot enjoying the sun or having fun by the beach, for example.
Got it. So essentially for Cherry, we could give you the logo and suddenly you would place the logo in San Francisco, in Berlin, in like on the Euros or in different, and you would show logo generation. Now, what is the important part? Let's take Cherry again. There is the font. There is the color. Maybe we like the logo to be placed on a sailboat, like we are always discussing to doing here a Segel event with founders. But like,
invite me.
like, here we go. But it's on a sailboat, could be nice. But we might as well recreate the logo in water style. So now the color is missing, and also but we keep the font. How do you decide what is important for us as an organization?
Today, most of this is done with a human in the loop. Basically, we have an open discussion with you. We look at your brand guidelines, and usually, like, we only work with brands which have an already like existing brand book, brand kit, and so on. If you haven't like figured out what is important for you, like if you are just thinking about creating your brand, we're not the right solution. Usually we have this discussion with the client. Then we make a test. So we train the model based on our understanding. We give them access to the solution based on their feedback. We adapt that to ensure we are constantly on brand. Going forward, we will probably productize that part. So LLMs now are very good at understanding an image. And this is exactly the type of thing. And this is where, you know, we're starting to go from a feature to a product. But he was like, oh, okay, actually I need to add an LLM here to understand, maybe to re-interact with the diffusion model, which is generating the visual itself, and to make a loop between the LLM and the diffusion model to get to the right asset.
Okay, understood.
I would love to tell the model that part different color, that part larger, etc. So I would like to split it up versus just having a prompt that then changes everything again. Is that already possible or not? Is that actually important in your workflow to be able one day to do this?
One of the other key parts, which again, from the feature to the product.
Yeah.
So basically the diffusion models, it's a model itself plus the editing modules on top of that doesn't understand, like wouldn't understand if you like make it blue.
Yeah.
But here, what we're building is a conversational agent. So we understand that when you say, oh, make it blue, it means actually the background should be blue, or it means, you know, write that instead at this point. And so today we started doing that with just understand your inputs. We built this conversational product only for the input, not the iteration yet, but this is definitely where we're going.
We have two challenges. Right? And then you tell me whether this is correct. Challenge number one is we need to extract what are the correct guidelines. If I say we take this video here now, and yes, this is a podcast, but dear podcast listener, we actually recording a video. So now if I take this video and say, I want Ferdinand and myself sitting on a vast plaza, we had Burning Man, just Burning Man. So we could be on the plier. And a huge Cherry logo in the background. And we have continued after this discussion. That is, we now need to extract that information, bundle it with the brand guidelines. And then the second problem is we need to do the rendering. And for the rendering, you're using a diffusion model and you train the diffusion model on the brand equities. Mm. And for that, you use a LoRA. Do you want to say something about what is a LoRA?
Basically, a LoRA is a retraining of the model, but instead of retraining all the model weights, you just do it on a few parameters.
Yes.
And so it basically enables you to have extremely consistent results, but in a pretty short, less than an hour training time. So it doesn't need all the compute of retraining the whole model.
Exactly. Now, meaning you have a neural network, you have a lot of weights and biases, and they are all pre-trained. And now LoRA is doing a low rank adjustment of those weights. Now, those adjustments need to work with the right data. So essentially, the first step, extracting the information, is the technical key part here. Okay, so now we have a product. Now,
do we have a feature or product already? It's the most annoying feedback of a VC, I guess, kind of saying, we think you still have a feature. Bottom line, a product is something you can sell in a package with a certain price and then at scale. So you could say it's just a combination of features that are solving a very concrete problem of a very concrete persona, user persona, or end buyer, so it could be different or same. But if you have a feature, it might be part of 100 things somebody has to do during a day, but a product is definitely more 5, 10, 20 things. And I'm covering a part of a workflow. I'm not doing one thing here, then 10 other things in a different tool, then two things at my tool, etc. So that makes it more a product. And then when you really come to the company, obviously, around it, that's how you sell it, how you support the customers, etc., etc. The very simple version of it. Where are you right now? I guess very early. So that's fine. But how, because we always come from this pain point, urgent pain. I mean, that's kind of what everybody loves, right? An urgent pain in a market that is changing and growing and that exactly needs your product. But where is the urgent pain? Where's the wow? Where you can convince someone, yeah, I really want this, although it's not perfect, but I still want to test it. You can get your user feedback. Can you describe a little bit your thinking there?
My first thinking is, I think this question is nothing new with AI. Like my last company, for example, Alma, it was split payment, basically. And Louis Chatrio, the CEO, used to work for Stripe. And he saw this demand coming from clients. They all said, I want a split payment solution. And Stripe could have done that, right? They had a distribution, they had a data and so on. They didn't decide to focus on something else. I'm thinking also about closer to our space about Photo Room. Photo Room is like background removal. You could think it's just a feature, but like both these businesses are on track to 100 million ARR. So the last 2 years of like Gen AI wave, this question applied. And I think like also why is that question that new is that you have two probably things that are changing. The first one is like AI creates a ton of opportunities and nobody understands like how fast incumbents will be able to ship AI features, which could indeed turn a lot of AI startups into just like features. My take here is that it's pretty difficult to build a good AI product because you have to deal with probability and uncertainty, and an established player doesn't like to deal with that at all.
You're already preempting the second question because we have a question on the AI product, but that's the way.
And the second part, which makes this question also quite relevant in the stage of AI, the new thing to that question is that like, there is some, like you have a lot of AI products or features that replace the job of a human today, like of a white collar job, you know? And there's no benchmark. There's no, like, we don't know how much people are ready to pay for that. Like, how will it compare with the willingness to pay with a, like, AI, with a brand designer, for instance?
Yeah. And it's also a pretty bad pitch if I come to you and say, I will replace your colleague. You need to want to replace your colleague right now.
Exactly. Actually, I think the replacement, like, pitch doesn't really work. Like nobody wants to fire half of their team, especially in Europe. I think in the US, the mindset might be a bit different.
No, I also think there is the question later on is only the cost reduction. You set a brand image because you sell a product, you have a huge market. That's the reason why you're working on your brand, right? And now if somebody says, you can save a little bit, and you're like, yes, but I have a higher risk not driving in my margin because my brand sucks. Yeah. So that's, you wouldn't do that. Mm. So that's why you said you go to small, medium companies.
Yeah. Exactly.
Who do not yet have that capability.
Yeah. Exactly.
We only saw that working, by the way, in industries where there's high churn, high turnover, like call center, customer care, because then there's definitely an effect of automating. But the biggest driver is then the onboarding of the people, supporting the people, make them work easier, right? So it's, again, not really cost cutting at the end.
Yes. I think the way we see it today, I think there's like several things to be qualified as a product, not a feature. But at the beginning, the lines are very blurry. The way I see it, like we bring today an additional capacity to a company. So they don't have a brand design team or they have a very limited bandwidth. Mm-hmm. And so we enable them to express their brand like they could never have imagined that. And so they are like, wow, actually, it feels like magic. That's a bit the first point. Like we bring an additional capacity. I'm not saying I will increase your efficiency by X percent. So I fill a gap basically in their current capacities. That's the first thing. And I do that by targeting very precisely which type of clients I'm going after. Like they have a brand identity. They know how they want to communicate, but they have limited resources. And this is why my pitch resonates with them. And then like going further, of course, like we need to have a strong vision. Because to build like what basically wouldn't have been possible before Gen AI. basically, I just use my feature to build what Adobe has done before. Like, my business will remain a feature business for sure.
Yeah, makes true. That's true. One thing we said in our founder coaching, where you were also a part of at Station F, and you already alluded to it, it's probability. So the big question with AI products is, how can I make the experience for the customer good enough? Because I don't have all the data, I don't have trained the model best, like well enough at scale, etc. So this initial customers, how do I make sure the feedback is relevant? Because I have to make sure the product experience is good enough. In comparison, when I just write software, it's not that easy, I know, but I'm not a computer scientist, so I can say it. I know exactly what I have to write, there are rules, I built the output, fine, right? I test the experience.
I actually want to add a word to this. The minimum, not viable, but quality product. Because Adobe cannot ship lower quality compared to you guys as a startup. We have seen this before, right? We have seen this by, for example, Word, top of the line, and then Google came and says, well, it's good enough if I take a viability, which is lower, not quality is lower, like response time was not as fast and so on and so forth, but like you got other things for it.
Yeah.
How do you define for you this minimum quality? What is it?
Today, basically, we have this two-step process. We try the model, we test. If we think it's okay, we ship it to the client and then we see if it works for them.
So they have the human in the loop.
They have the human in the loop. And that's a good thing of our business, is that at the end of it's hard sometimes because, you know, design beautiful and so on. Like, does it match what I had in mind? It's a bit intangible. But at the end of the day, there's a human in the loop and they're able to say, oh, okay, actually, this makes a cut or not.
But if, okay, got it, human in the loop. And how do you manage? Like, how, like, you go to later on a venture capitalist and says, guys, I have the perfect solution. I save a lot of money and scale a high margin product. At the moment, you have a low margin product, which is not scalable because you have the human in the loop. How do you measure? What's the key metrics here?
The key metric for what? Like, for to make it scalable?
Or like, you have two, right? Make it scalable and as well, don't have the cost. Right. So at what point in time do you feel, how do you measure? Okay. I created now a Cherry logo and I checked it. I shipped it. That's fine. At what point in time do you ship it without having to check it?
So basically the cost of the human in the loop is not that high for us.
All right.
Because we have a recurring product and we sell in B2B. So the price, basically the payback on the initial cost, if it was outsourced to a like, freelance designer that costs us like 300 euros per day, for instance, or 500 euros per day, the cost here would be paid back quite fast because it's a one-off cost for us. And then the rest of the human in the loop job is done by our client. So if the initial check is done is good, that we make the cut often enough, then the human in the loop check made by the client is minimal enough so they are happy with the output and don't churn.
Cool. Okay. Now, so let's say you have the lower margin. It really works and people are happy and you actually produce higher quality. Couldn't the big corporations who are out there, who have customers, offer this as a service?
Well, if tomorrow Adobe puts $100 million on the table to do exactly what we're doing, I think they will figure out at some point, given the advancement of my product today. But first, when you look at just Figma, like one of the best companies in our space, Figma released their AI product. They had to roll it back because they got like complaints about like the usage of their own clients' data and so on. So first, it's not easy to ship an AI product for incumbents. Second, Canva, which is probably the most inspiring player in our space, they have a ton of different segments to address. They have all these small designers, these small companies that want AI to facilitate, I don't know, I'm a restaurant, I want to do a menu. They try to target large enterprises too, and they're going more and more after Adobe's clients. So they will have specific needs for these guys. They will want to do some like graphic design, they will want to do like video. So they have a ton of needs and they need to prioritize. And our advantage is our speed and our focus on the exact pain points of our clients, basically.
And if I specify it, you're basically saying they would need the feedback loop of all these customers, understand the feedback loop, incorporate it maybe in the same model or different models for different segments. That's a huge, huge task. And you can just focus on your one segment with your limited product with lower expectations. And from there, from the ground up, you can build it, which is basically how Figma also started and Canva started, if you think of it.
Exactly.
And I think we should, and this is for everybody out there who thinks about, oh, should I build something? And then thinks about like, but like the big corporations could eat your lunch. It is not as easy because you have a higher quality, number one, for all of your constraints. And number two, and you glanced over it very quickly, but I would like to add my experience here to this. You actually said it ain't that easy. And it is true. I just recently published an online course for AI and generative AI. And it's 5 courses. We roll it out. And one of the things that I did there is we integrated OpenAI into the course. So the students have a co-pilot teaching assistant, essentially, they can use for analytics, for building, for coding, for whatsoever. There's a lot of stuff they do with them. Now, the problem I saw with the students is, yes, everybody theoretically has used ChatGPT, but using it in a way so that you do summarization correctly or coding or analytics correctly is actually a skill I needed to train. So I actually recently built a module just teaching the students how to prompt correctly the assistant. And that shows you there is a barrier you have to jump over to get actually to the right setup. So everybody looks at ChatGPT and says like, oh, you're a startup who's just wrapped around ChatGPT. But in reality, it's more complicated than that.
Exactly. I think that's one of the paradoxes of AI. It's very easy to get the proof of concept right. So it's very easy to get, wow, that's awesome. But when you want to productize, and when you're a large company, you want to productize for hundreds of millions of users, things become tricky.
I think that's very well said.
And the second one, what we discussed a lot, Lutz and I, is it's also a different way of interaction with the product from an interface perspective. So when you think of products, we mentioned Adobe a lot, but there are obviously others, Paintbrush. But there are a lot of buttons out there and you use them in a less iterative way. You might scribble something, then you fine tune it, however you call it as a designer. But maybe your interface would look very, very different to that. You wouldn't even show all the buttons at the beginning. Maybe never. Maybe you interact, you talk with it in a totally different form. You just upload pictures as form of input.
Yeah, exactly. And basically, if you're Canva or Adobe, you cannot say, okay, let's start from scratch. Let's just rebuild everything with these AI mindflows in mind. It's hard for them also to get the right UX. So yeah, I mean, that's another interesting point.
Like mobile first companies were a thing for a while.
Exactly.
And so I have a VC question.
Go ahead.
So I want to ask about your moat because we were now from feature to product and company, but the moat is boring, right? It's just something around your castle and it's protecting you. You're in offense mode, right? You're not defense. You don't have a castle yet. It's maybe a small village or a house there. So in ancient times, we called it unique selling proposition. But if you think of your company in the future, obviously there will be something defensible, some moat that you're creating because you did it in a special way. But how would you attack the others out there? And where would you eat someone's lunch? Where is the unique selling proposition to customers where they should buy you and not others, if you want to share it here in the podcast?
So who do you define as others? Like others competing startups, incumbents?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably larger agencies. It's probably tools that you might replace partially. It could be even a person, obviously, internally. But there has to be a reason why the 10x, or maybe it's just a 2x, but why you are so much better than what is currently being used out there. So that's convincing people. And the mode is obviously more defending your position in the market.
I think like the convincing people to get in, we discussed it a bit like already, to, you know, like which specific pain point you tackle, like which ICP and so on. If I think like 5 years from now, if you go fast and you're successful, you will quickly get a lot of data because of typical modes, but that's true. And one advantage that we have, for instance, targeting only B2B is that we have clean data. So we don't suffer from this like garbage in, garbage out that can happen with like prosumer or consumer products. So this is one of the first things. The second thing is that you have a lock-in effect with clients, because when they have all your, basically the model works well for them, plus they have all their data stored within your platform, why would they change? I think there's a kind of virtual cycle over there, because the more like this locking effect makes your product better for your own clients and also makes it easier for you to create a lot of value for newcomers.
How is your feeling about agencies? Because I've been investing in a couple of businesses that were replacing human agency work with AI. And you could argue customers always enjoy a certain consulting workshops, you know, this kind of personal interaction. They just don't want to speak to a chatbot all the time or click buttons. So how do you see yourself in this industry in 5 years when the product is just amazing, high quality?
I tend to think there will be a split, and a split is already happening actually, between creativity and production. Mm-hmm. So creativity, I think, will remain. I believe in the like super creative thing, because the cost basically for a very creative person to ship a super creative idea will be reduced. But this is great. Like this is a new, your like strong idea for your new marketing campaign and so on. But in the day to day of marketing teams, there is a need for production. And here, I think one of the big pain points that we're solving is that it's easier to have the marketing guy thinks about, okay, what do I need, and make their own visual than having a like brainstorming or discussion between like two human beings. And here, yes, it will be less creative, maybe less awesome in some cases. On the production part, I think the agencies has way less value. I think agencies will become way strong, like will keep thriving on like very creative ideas.
Yeah. Could also be for consultants, right? When you think of slide writing and you don't send it somewhere to design it. So Lutz and Ferdinand just left to have a, I'm pretty sure, a very, very good coffee in San Francisco. So they left me here in Hop Berlin. Summing up what we just learned, I'm pretty impressed by the approach of Lasco AI and Ferdinand and his team, because it's not really easy, as you might have, to tame these diffusion models and make them productive in a B2B context. So having customers with pretty specific wants and needs, and then a model trained, or several models actually trained in a way that I can say, hey, these are my assets, my visual assets, and I want a certain style of output, quality, scenery, and the like. So the approach they're using, the thoughtfulness around the need, but also pragmatism, how to scale this with feedback loops from the customers, avoiding high costs, but also bad user experience, because as we know, these models are not perfect. It's probabilistic distributions. That was very, very interesting. We didn't even tackle the part of AI agents, because again, these are different models, and also they are applying them in certain workflows, and the agents play a certain role. But yeah, just give Ferdinand a call and maybe he'll tell you about it. We have other founders coming up with whom we will have deep dives on the application of AI agents, which is quite, quite interesting and also very challenging. So subscribe and something will come up. Thank you for listening.